It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And we got a guest today, a true A-lister, talking about the lovely and talented Elizabeth Hurley making her Talk is Jericho debut. The former model turned actress has a brand new movie out, and it was written and directed by her 22-year-old son, Damien. Movie's called Strictly Confidential. It's available now on demand and wherever you stream movies. In addition to acting in the film, Elizabeth also serves as a producer. She talks about what it was like working with her son from both a professional perspective and as his mum, as we say in the Commonwealth in Canada and the UK. Elizabeth shares some great stories about Mike Myers and the Austin Powers movies, working with director Harold Ramis on Bedazzled, what she thinks of Fulham Football Club, which of course is owned by my boss, Tony Khan. Before we get to Elizabeth, though, so we'll talk about a few other things. It's actually pretty funny. Just so you guys know why this Elizabeth interview is so short. It started out as a 45-minute interview, and then Elizabeth was about 10 minutes tardy, shall we say. She couldn't figure out the technology of the StreamYard, which takes some time at times. And then at about 25 minutes into the interview, we started getting messages from her publicist saying, "Wrap it up. She got to wrap up. She got a heart out." We're like, "I thought we had 45 minutes. And it's like, "No, she needs to be off the phone now." So I, of course, Jericho'd about another, two questions or maybe three questions. But just so you guys know, that's how it works sometimes when you're doing interviews. These are people doing press junkets and very much have to be on schedule. So if you draw the short straw and only have 10 minutes to 10 minutes to figure out how to use the technology, then that gets 10 minutes taken off the back end, which actually happened to us almost when we opened for Iron Maiden back in September of 2019, where the opening band Raven's Age went about 10 minutes over in their set. So how it works is when Raven Age starts, and let's say they're going 6 to 7:30 and Fozzy goes 7 to 7:45 and Iron Maiden comes on at 8:45 or whatever it is. There's a famous saying in the rock and roll world: "I don't know what time you're starting, but I know what time you're finishing." And that's the exact time you're supposed to. So we were behind the gun because Raven's Age went 10 minutes late. So we had to really step it up. Sam Abernathy, our amazing stage manager, and of course Rich Ward, the technical genius, were able to get our changeover, which is how you get your gear on stage and their gear off, in a scant 15 minutes when it usually takes about 25. So, and if we hadn't done that, if it would have taken the same time as it usually does, then guess what? Fozzy doesn't play 45 minutes that night. Fozzy plays 10 minutes. Plays 35 minutes that night because they went 10 minutes over. So that's kind of what happened here with Elizabeth going 10 minutes over. And that's showbiz. What are you going to do, right? Like, you can't really freak out about it because they're going to go. We don't know what time you're starting, but we know what time you're finishing. And that's exactly what happened with Elizabeth. But it was awesome conversation with her. And lots of good stuff going on right now in AEW. I know it's been a busy pro wrestling season, but there's a lot of cool stuff going. Very, very excited about what's going on with Lionhook. And of course, if you missed Collision this week, although Collision did a huge rating, it's interesting because we were on at 11:30 at night. And I was thinking, wow, who's going to stick around to watch wrestling after WrestleMania and after the March Madness? And guess what? We did a better rating this week than we did last week. So maybe we have to go on to 11:30 at night and compete with Saturday Night Live. Maybe that might be the way to go, but the way to go, shall we speak? The match was Lionhook against Shane Taylor Promotions. Really enjoyed working with Shane Taylor and Lee Moriarty. had a really good match. And at the end, as Hook and I were celebrating, Anthony Ogogo came down and attacked us, and Shane Taylor Promotions laid us out. Anthony Ogogo knocked me out with a knockout punch. And if you don't know his history, Anthony Ogogo is a legit boxing Olympian, medal-winning Olympian. I think he got a bronze medal at the Olympics for England in boxing. And he's a really famous star there. I think he's done kind of like whatever English version is of I'm a Celebrity and I'm Stuck in the Wilderness or whatever, those types of shows, or maybe it was Big Brother or whatever the heck it is. But he's got big name value in the UK. He's been under contract with us here in AW for a long time, and now he's back. And boy, what a right hand throw he threw at me. Tell you what, I've been punched by the best. Anthony Ogogo, Mike Tyson, Mickey Rourke, you name it. Line them up and I'll take right hands from all of them. Really enjoying working with Hook and the story that we're telling. And of course, there's a lot of relation there between Hook and his father, Taz, who was not my first match in ECW, but he was my second, my first one ever at the ECW arena. And the story of the match was, at the time, Taz never left his feet, and Taz basically suplexed me on my head. But prior to that, I was able to German suplex him, which was a huge deal. That WWE Hall of Famer, Paul Heyman, put that spot in there to really get me over in my first time in the ECW arena, because ECW arena was filled with very hardcore fans who knew me from Japan and knew me from Mexico. So it was a big deal to have the last student of the Stu Hart dungeon take Taz off his feet. That was a Paulie idea, once again. And Taz then reciprocated by dumping me on my head. And the idea was I got stretchered out. Brian Pillman came in to confront Taz and was freaking out when Pillman was doing the loose cannon gimmick. And then Pillman ran out of the ring and jumped into the arms of Philadelphia Eagles football player Harry Boatswain. And sadly, both of those guys aren't with us anymore. But I remember I was dumped on my head there. And as I was being stretchered out, this guy in the crowd's like, "Jericho, you're a beep. Just like your father." Of course, my dad played for the New York Rangers, Teddy Irvin, and people from Philly do not like people from the Rangers. So I was a beep, and you can use your, expletive deleted, use your imagination what he called me. But yeah, so that was kind of my first experience in ECW. The lesser known is when I had some kind of like an actual judo match against Taz at the Lost Battalion Hall in Queens, New York, where Taz had a judo coach who paid off the referee, Bill Alfonso. And I remember Paul Lee was telling the Taz's judo coach or whoever it was, "Make sure when you pay off Fonzie, you take the bell and you lick your thumb and you take 100 and you lick your thumb 200, 300 and kind of count out the $500 or whatever it was that he paid off the evil referee so that Taz could cheat to beat me in this judo rules match we had. Of course, what judo experience did Chris Jericho have in 1996? The answer is zero. What judo experience did Chris Jericho have in 2024? Answer, still zero. But that was kind of my initial time working with Taz. And then, of course, I worked with Taz a few times when he came to WWF, I believe it was at the time. Maybe it was WWE by then. Chris Jericho versus Taz. SmackDown 2002. I'm just looking up this information. Jackie was the special ref. I was the undisputed champion at the time. And I guess I used to chew gum when I walked to the ring back then. You know, it was kind of a 90s, early 2000s heel trick. You chew gum like you're a real cocky asshole coming to the ring and chewing that gum. But yeah, apparently the story of that match is I beat Taz and then I put Jackie in the Walls of Jericho. I guess just because she wouldn't raise my hand in victory, because I guess she was a good guy and I was a bad guy. So I taught her a lesson, put her in the Walls of Jericho, which you could never do nowadays, but things were a lot different back then in the Attitude Era. So that leads us to Hook now with Lion Hook, and it's pretty crazy to think I've been in the business long enough for these guys that I used to work with now have sons that are wrestling. I'm talking about David Finley and Davey Boy Smith and the late great Davey Boy Smith, and of course Taz, and I'm sure there's a multitude of others that I can think of that that have started to wrestle that I used to know your dad. Like, so ridiculous, right? But still rocking it and still enjoying being in AW, and like I said, I think we got some really cool things up and coming for all you guys. So I appreciate you following us and sticking with us and making us one of the top two or three shows, if not the number one show on all of cable every Wednesday night. So we appreciate that. And thanks for watching us on Collision. And thanks for listening here on Talk is Jericho. Elizabeth Hurley, didn't get a chance to ask her about her time with Hugh Grant, but that's kind of what put her on the scene. And right when I asked her about her, her safety pin dress that kind of put her on the map when she did the Golden Globes with Hugh or whatever it was, that's when they started giving me the message of you gotta get her off the phone. She's done. So I think it's one of the best 30-minute interviews that I've ever done on Talk is Jericho. Don't think it's a new trend because it's not. It just I've done a couple short ones. Adam Carolla, I had a short one with him one time. Rudolph Shankar was a short one. There's times when they only want you to do 30 minutes, and I'm usually able to stretch it out a couple extra minutes. This time I was swornhoggled. I was barn baffled by the evil publicist who came on to tell me that my interview is being unfairly cut short due to technological issues. But just like Fozzy did with Iron Maiden, Chris Jericho did it with Talk is Jericho here and rescued the show and still had a great one. And Elizabeth Hurley was an amazing guest. She was lovely. We had a great conversation. And here it is on Talk is Jericho. I want to jump in here right away, learning some factoids about you. You are a huge Fulham football fan. Is this true?
Well, I live in Fulham, and some of my close friends are huge Fulham fans. Are you a Fulham fan?
Well, I work for Tony Khan, who is the general manager of Fulham and owns the team. So by proxy, I am now a Fulham fan.
Then I feel that I'm also a Fulham fan because it is my local, and I should be. I'm not actually a soccer fan.
So, gotcha.
But if I were one, I would be Fulham all the way. How's that?
All right. We'll be Fulham pinky friends now, yeah, for sure. That's funny, sure, though. Like, once again, because you read it on the internet, it must be true, right?
Of course. So, how could it not be? Yeah.
Yeah. But we're so much to discuss today, and I just want to just jump in here with Strictly Confidential, doing a little bit of, you know, reading about this and stuff. First of all, this is a movie that you're making with your son, and your son is like one of the most striking people I've ever seen. This kid is like drop dead gorgeous, like the model of all models. You must be a proud mum.
I'm a very proud mum. Of course I am. I think I was terrified when he got the news that Lionsgate wanted him to make a feature film. He'd made a short film, which he wrote and directed, and that I was also in a few months previous to getting this call, and somebody had seen his short film and offered him this opportunity. And my initial reaction, I was thrilled and terrified at the same time, because mm-hmm. I knew he had the talent to direct really well, to supervise the edit, to supervise the post. I didn't have any problems with him doing any of that, even though he was, to me, of course, still a baby. Mm-hmm. But anybody who's been in the industry for a while, and I've been in it for a long time, you know that it's every day is a battle. Every day you're fighting for something. And as the director, I knew that he'd have 1,000 people asking him 1,000 questions every day, all of which he'd have to deal with and not get distracted from doing what I knew he could do, which was direct the film. So I came on board as a producer right when he got offered the opportunity to make this film. And from then on, I knew that I could try and protect him from our evil industry and leave him free to do what he can do. And I have to say, he's done a beautiful job. He's made a really fantastic movie. I love it.
So it must be kind of interesting because, once again, you're coming at this from all different sides. One, you've been in the business for many years, so you're a veteran. Two, like you said, you're producing. Three, you're starring. But also, on top of that, you're Mama Bear. And you mentioned protecting him from our wonderful industry. What kind of things did you have to try and help him with that he might not know as a first-time director green to the biz?
Well, I think the most important thing for people coming into a new industry, any industry, is to have the ability to stay completely focused on what you have to do creatively and not let the other stuff take you away from your vision and from your path. And to me, that's the most difficult thing, because people get so overwhelmed with the problems and the logistics and the fact there's a storm coming and you can't shoot the scene you planned.
Right.
All that stuff to keep laser vision focused on what you have to keep doing. I have to say, he really managed to do that with me taking a lot of the flack of the awful stuff and leaving him to direct. And I think it was really just the protecting him from that, knowing that so many people would be saying, the costumes haven't landed, the costumes didn't clear customs, the makeup girl is stranded in Florida, all this stuff which can distract you. That's what I was most scared of. But then if I was allowed to be a mama bear too, which I wasn't really allowed to on this, of course, I worried that he wasn't eating properly. And I worried that he wasn't getting enough sleep and all that sort of thing. So that I had to really rein back on and stay as his producer. And then, of course, when I was called on set as an actress, and we didn't have, that was great. That part of it, when I was stepping on set in my costume, in character, and he was directing, it was great. I couldn't have loved it more. The producing side was a tougher side for me. Mama Bear, poor Mama Bear, she had to get shut in a closet and not allowed to enter, really.
But that's the thing, there's some professionalism that you have to show and not kind of be too overbearing, because this is your son. But once again, like you said, he's the boss of the movie. He's the director. So I'm sure it's a fine line when you have to deal with both of those.
I think so. I think me as his producer by his side, as his producing partner, it was a fabulous relationship, which started right from when you mentioned when his film, he got this opportunity to make this film, right up until 5 minutes ago when we just did a joint interview to promote the US opening of the movie. We've worked side by side with no problems at all. That was great. Producing partner's fantastic. Director, actress, fantastic. It's only when Mummy tries to step in that there's ever any friction. So Mummy's backed off for a while. He can wear what he likes. I won't interfere. I won't say you should have steamed that shirt. I won't do any of that. Why didn't you line everything up last night? Mummy stepped back, and then all is calm when Mummy steps back.
When he was asking you to try something during a take, for example, if he's that type of a director, would you do it even if you felt differently that maybe your idea was better? Did you give him that, that sort of right as well?
Yeah, no, he was the total boss on the director, the total boss in the edit suite, totally. And I've never second guessed or doubted him for a second on any of that. He's been making baby movies since he was 8 when I gave him his first camcorder. And he's corralled everybody we know, mostly me, obviously, to being in so many movies through the years. We've got all of them, which he edited. He didn't have Final Cut then. What did he have? Video, whatever they used to cut their videos on.
Right.
And he didn't start off writing in Final Draft. You know, he used to write in Word or by hand when he was 8, handing us our lines. So it's been so much part of our life that people have said, oh my God, must it have been awful taking direction from him? And I'm like, I've been doing it for 12 years. So that was fine. That was fine. It's just my concerns were just being mature enough to cope with the rest of the flack. And he's risen. I'm going to produce his next movie. I won't be in it, but I'll produce it. Mm-hmm. And then I really feel that, he was only 22 yesterday. He's still very young.
Wow.
But as an artist, he's fine. Mm-hmm. It's just the other stuff that's tough sometimes for someone younger, I think. Because it is, it's a tough business.
Well, especially like you mentioned in this business too, and there's probably going to be people going, oh, it's nepotism. He's only getting the opportunity because of his mom. And I'm sure you're like, okay, just wait and see what's going to happen. But you help him get kind of the foot in the door and then let him kick through it, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, him getting to make this movie did he meet the people who got to see his short through me? He did. But I've never written and directed a movie. So there's no part of him being able to do that because Mummy was a famous film director. I mean,
right.
You're not. I've never directed a film. I've never written a film. So that was all on him. And if anyone would still entertain those thoughts, they would only have to see him on the set for a second to know that that's his home. That's where there's people will be disabused of that notion within a second. That is for sure. As would anyone who spent time with him in the editing suite, during the post-production, grading the film, sitting with the composer. It's him. It's not me. I've never done those things myself. It's him.
Because you mentioned he wrote the whole film as well.
Absolutely. This came from, he had an idea for a treatment during lockdown, actually, when he was around 17, 18, whatever. He had this idea. He wrote a treatment and put it in a drawer because he lost a friend to suicide when he was 17. And he just had all these feelings that all, you know, they were really young. And they were brand new feelings for all these kids. And he could see that some of his friends found it, and to this day, find it incredibly hard to come to terms with what this girl did. So he started this treatment and put it away. But then when he got this opportunity to write his first real grown-up film, he decided to pull on that. And when you see the film, you'll see that this film is about a girl who couldn't accept that her friend committed suicide and wanted to find the reasons why, wanted to find the answers. And she goes on this quest to find the answers. And during this journey, she finds out that Rebecca, the girl who committed suicide, who's my daughter in the film, mm-hmm. she finds that all the family and friends all are hiding things, all of which could have reflected on the state of mind of Rebecca. And Mia, our protagonist, goes on this adventure finding out all these things. And my character also has a terrible secret. She's guilty. Everybody's guilty of something. And Mia finds all this out, and it turns into this amazing sort of mystery, a sensual mystery about what happened to Rebecca. And I think he told the story amazingly. He's got amazing twists and turns in it, none of which I could ever have come up with. It's a really clever story about a lot of young people, apart from me. Everyone in the movie's under 25. He really wanted mm-hmm. his first movie to be with young people. He felt he knew young people because he is one. He knows how they think, how they speak, how they act, why they're doing things which a more mature person might not do. And, you know, it's a very interesting time when you understand that young voices are so important. You know, when I think of stories, when I think of ideas for things, they very often involve people in my age group and experiences I've gone through. That's completely normal. But it's very interesting to step aside and see what young people are thinking of, what their problems are, how they would deal with something. And those stories, you know, they have an audience. People want to hear that. And it's pretty amazing that it's not a much older person telling young people what they would have been thinking and what they could have been, how they could have reacted. This is a young person, and his friends did react this way. And I love it for that freshness.
It's interesting, too, because obviously, I mean, with Damien, you mentioned his friend had committed suicide. Obviously, his father did as well. How is that for you playing this? And obviously, he's drawing from such a personal place. And I'm sure that affects you, too, as an actor trying to tap into that.
Well, you know, Damien he plays his cards very close to his chest. And, you know, we had a big New York premiere of this movie 2 nights ago. And obviously, I've seen the movie 10,000 times because I was in the edit. But seeing it up there on the big screen with all our friends and family around us, I saw some symbolism in the film that I didn't even know was there. Hmm. And I have lived and breathed this film with Damien for a year and a half. But he doesn't shout about those things. So there were things that I've picked up that he didn't even tell us were there. Sometimes I think you put things subliminally into things.
Right.
And just conscious is putting these things in, or maybe he's been dropping those breadcrumbs all along and it takes a while to pick them up. Some people never will. He said that he noticed something in the film that he knew full well it was in the film because we've cut it, edited it, done everything else with it. But he didn't actually realize that it meant something so deep to him until he saw it too. It's a really interesting thing.
Well, and once again, you've done so many roles and so many great roles throughout your career. Something a little bit more serious and dramatic, like Strictly Confidential, and then you're going to doing Marvel parts. like playing Morgan Le Fay. How do you approach, obviously we know how you approach the movies directed and written by your son. How do you approach playing a Marvel character? Because the Marvel universe is so intricate and so huge with the fan base that is super critical of everything. How did you get into that mindset?
I loved playing Morgan Le Fay. I just loved it. I had never done anything like that before, even though with some things I've done before, well, what I had done before is worn a catsuit. And it was quite fun because my first day on set on Runaways, I was in Morgan's fantasy costume. So I was in, you know, her big green catsuit with hair. Oh, God, sorry, hit the TV. With hair and whatever. And we were shooting at Paramount on the beautiful sound stages, which for an English girl is always still a fantasy right. Through when I drive through onto those studio lots. And there was a crew member there who was holding a fan on my hair, which was going wild. And it was a big green screen thing. And after we'd shot it, he went, yeah, you know, the last time I held a fan on you was when we shot Bedazzled. And he said, you were also in a cat suit. I was blowing your hair and it was green screen. I was like, oh my God, 20 years on, nothing's changed. Show business. Acting like cat suit, different color, but doing exactly the same thing. And I kind of really loved that. So it was great to tap into that. And, you know, Runaways was for kids with kids in it. And again, I really like that. It's really nice when you cross a generation. When I gave up for a long time, I took 7 or 8 years off when I had my son because I wanted to stay home and really try and be a good mom. And then the first thing I did going back was a season of Gossip Girl in New York. And that was really interesting for me because it really found a completely different age group of audience for me, who all the youngsters who loved Gossip Girl. It opened a lot of doors for me in a way that I hadn't even imagined that it would. And I loved that. And Runaways was the same. You know, Marvel, of course, is quite a male-dominated audience as well, as opposed to Gossip Girl, you know, which is very female-driven, young female. But nevertheless, it was really untapping new audiences. And I love that. It's really exciting as an actor to reach different people.
Did you get a lot of feedback from the Marvel fanatics about that?
Yeah, and they've been dying for Morgan Le Fay now to go into a movie. I'm like, guys, I'm with you.
I'm right here.
Yeah, you could go for that. Because they do say that once somebody plays a character in the Marvel Universe, that's their character. So I'm like, I'm ready.
Like forever.
Yeah, forever. Yeah.
Well, and they're getting like, you know, there's been 18 Spider-Mans and Iron Mans. They need some new characters. I think the door is ready for Morgan Le Fay for sure.
Start a campaign.
I just spoke with Ernie Hudson a couple of days ago about Ghostbusters, and we mentioned Harold Ramis and just working with him. And obviously you just said Bedazzled, which was directed by Harold Ramis. I'm a huge Harold Ramis fan. I'm from Canada. I grew up with SCTV where he was very involved in that. So tell me a little bit about how it was working with Harold, what you learned from him. And once again, this movie Bedazzled was 25 years ago. You're probably pretty young in the business yourself. Like, what are your memories of him, of working with him?
I loved Harold. He was such a wonderful man to learn from. You know, he'd made these hugely successful comedies. And I was really nervous because that was just, when I got Bedazzled, I'd shot Austin Powers. But I'd only for a few years been just offered things. You know, I'd been auditioning for years and years and years for things. And Bedazzled just came in as an offer saying, you know, Harold Ramis would love you, the devil. I was like, seriously? And I was like, I was so overwhelmed by it. And I went to meet him. I think we shot that at Fox. I can't remember where we shot it. We were, again, on beautiful sound stages. And he was such a lovely man. And I said, I'm really a bit scared to do this. You know, it's a huge part, obviously a huge star. You're a huge director. And this is a huge part. And I'm really quite nervous. And he was just so wonderful in talking me through why he wanted me to do it. You know, I don't know if you ever saw the original Bedazzled. It was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
Right.
And so he'd made the devil a woman in this and changed it all around. And he was so adamant that he wanted me to do it. And really, really helped me on it so much. And I was devastated when I heard that he died young, too young. I think he was 67 or something when he died. It was too young.
Yeah.
And he's just he was a marvelous voice and a marvelous man. And, you know, I'm often asked if I've had bad experiences over the years with directors. And I haven't, because I think I was incredibly lucky that I worked with gentlemen like Harold and just got that opportunity to be with decent people. He was a wonderful family man who just happened to be so gifted. And that was just a stroke of luck.
And it's a big deal too, like explain to people that don't understand the acting world. And for me as a, you know, an actor that has done a few things, when you get the offer, it's such a big deal. Like you mentioned, like auditioning is fine, but when you are offered something, which means they wrote it for you, the producers and directors want just you, that's a whole different level of making it, so to speak.
Yeah, it feels amazing.
Yeah.
If you get to that stage and that happens to you, it's completely different. It's completely different. I think it makes you work even harder. You know, you never want to let anyone down.
Right.
And you really want them to feel good that that's the direction they went in. And it's quite humbling, actually. I always feel really humbled when I'm offered something. I'm happy, but humbled.
You want to work harder because you want to make the people look like geniuses and not look like idiots. Like, oh my gosh, you put Jericho in this. It was terrible.
That's right. You don't want to let anyone down. And yeah, it means a lot actually when it happens.
Did you get offered Austin Powers or did you have to audition for that?
I got offered Austin Powers too. And that was an extraordinary thing because that really was one of my first offers, which I didn't have to fight for. And I remember it so clearly. I was in Toronto, funnily enough. I was filming, I was producing Extreme Measures with my then boyfriend, Hugh. And I was frazzled. It was a big, expensive studio production. And it was my first time producing. And I was really frazzled. And I remember in the morning, cell phones had just come in. I remember in the morning, I just got this email saying, Mike Myers would love you to play opposite him in a movie called Austin Powers. And I was like, what? And I said to my then boyfriend, Hugh, look at that. He went, oh, just say yes. Mike Myers is a genius. Say yes. I'm like, what do you mean? What do I have to do? Comedy. I've never really done any comedy. He's like, just say yes. Just say yes. You don't even need to read the script. Say yes. I'm like, I'm going to read the script. So I read the script. It was hysterical.
Right.
And so I said yes immediately. And then later I found out that Mike had seen me on a talk show. And apparently as soon as I came on camera, this was in the 90s, he went, oh, that's Vanessa Kensington. And it was that lucky. Years of fighting, years of auditioning. And he saw me on a talk show and went, yeah.
But I have a theory, Elizabeth, I say all the time, you never know who's watching.
No.
No matter what it is you're doing, you never know who's watching. And that's a perfect example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. The things that happen by chance sometimes, a chance meeting in an elevator or just something. I know then we just have these sliding door moments. You know, if Mike hadn't seen that talk show,
right,
I'd have got Austin Powers and then maybe I wouldn't have got that or maybe I'd have got that. And, you know, you just don't know. But chances are wonderful if they happen to go your way.
No, I remember that because this is Mike Myers kind of at his peak, you know, the 90s, mid 90s. And that you mentioned your boyfriend, Hugh. And I think, you know, as a kid in my 20s, I'd seen you, whatever. But in Austin Powers, suddenly now you are in the public eye. This was like your big break for guys of my generation. Did you feel that as well? Was it a big, big deal to be in that movie?
Yeah, it really made a difference to be in something which would go on to become a cult. Because interestingly, the first movie, which was really my movie, it did well, but it wasn't, it did well because it was extraordinary and Mike was unbelievable as Austin, but it was like, whoa, what is this? And then that built and built and built so that when number two came out, it was a massive smash in the box office. I've only got a small part in number two. But to this day, people, it's as big today as it ever was. And it's pretty amazing to be in a film like that, which resonates. My son watched it, for example, when he was about 8. He didn't understand the rude bits, obviously. He just loved it. The music, the costumes, the silliness. And, you know, there's people still dress bizarrely as me and Austin for Halloween and stuff. And it's kind of lovely. I like it. I like it a lot.
Did you kind of, and once again, just to clarify for people listening, the first Austin Powers did $67 million, the second one, $312 million. So like you mentioned, yeah, that's when it just really exploded. Did you get the humor that he was doing even more so because you are English?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, Mike's Canadian, but both his parents were from Liverpool in England. Yeah. So his humor was always on the English side, which means quite silly.
Yes.
Which made me laugh. I mean, on the set, he used to make me laugh, I mean, so much. I was really quite badly behaved on that set because I giggled so much. I used to get sent to my trailer sometimes because when I laugh, I start crying, then the makeup's gone and they got quite cross. So yeah, it is a very English sense of humor, I think, which just translated. And I love Mike. His humor was never cruel. It was just funny.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my favorite. There's no nasty aftertaste in anything Mike ever does. It's just funny. And I love that.
That's a great point. You know, it's interesting. I said, like, I grew up in Canada as well. And Canadian humor and British humor is very similar. Like you mentioned, silly. It's wacky. It doesn't make any sense. You know, there was so much of English comedy would be on, you know, PBS in Canada with Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and Blackadder. So very much similar sensibilities. So when I saw Austin Powers, I got it right away of just this ridiculousness. And like you mentioned, it's just, it holds up so well. And I say this with the ultimate compliment. It's so stupid. It's just stupid. Yeah. Some of the stuff that they made you guys do.
Yeah. It's just silly. Hysterical. The very first scene we shot actually was on the aeroplane where he's going around on that round bed, asking me if I found him horny with his bottom in the air. And it was so absurd.
Yeah.
When I went home that night, I mean, I laughed all day. But when I went home that night, I was like, what did we just shoot? What are people going to think when they see this? Lovely. They liked it. But it did take a while to catch.
Do you ever watch back any of your old stuff and see if it still holds up? For example, Austin Powers?
No. I mean, when my son was little, he was obsessed with Austin Powers and watched it all the time. So I'd walk in the room and, you know, watch a little bit. But I don't really watch myself in anything, to be honest. I had to watch myself in Strictly Confidential because I was in the edit suite.
Yeah.
But I can disassociate. I've also had a beachwear company for a long time and still do some of the modeling. And I can disassociate completely from it. I can discuss pictures in the third person. I can make suggestions for edits on scenes. It's not personal at all for me. I can do that.
Do you have a favorite scene from Austin Powers that stands out that you remember that you were in or that he was in?
My favorite. Yeah, probably the Burt Bacharach bit on the bus in Vegas. I love that. It was wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit more about that time when you were kind of just breaking out as a celebrity and as a star. You mentioned with being with Hugh, and I have to ask about the famous dress that everybody talks about all the time with the safety pins and all that sort of thing. Tell me about how that happened and how you felt about that. Cause it was a big, huge deal.
You know what? I never really understood it. It was a huge deal. Somebody said the other day, did you know that dress is about to have its 30th birthday? And I was like, what? I mean, obviously I don't really track the dress's birthdays, but evidently, it was just one of those things. It just happened by accident. It wasn't planned. When I look back at it, of course, it's fantastic. At the time, it was just a dress I borrowed. Went back first dress I'd ever borrowed. At that time, before that movie came out, Hugh and I were just jobbing actors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We worked. We weren't wealthy. We lived in a very small one-bedroom walk-up flat. We were very happy. But it was just, just another movie. It wasn't, we didn't know that it was going to catapult Hugh into being a superstar.
Right.
We didn't know my dress was going to become a superstar. It was just, you know, naive, happy times. Good memories.
Last question for you. What's your favorite part about working with your son, Damien, in Strictly Confidential?
I really trusted Damien to direct me and to be at the helm of this. He is like a dog with a bone. He doesn't let go when he wants something. He's a perfectionist. And frankly, I'd be so happy to continue to keep working with him because it's just wonderful to be with someone that cares that much. Mm-hmm. I don't like people phoning stuff in. I'm happy to work 23 hours a day, and so is he. So we're a good team in that way.
You must be very proud.
I'm a proud mummy. Yeah. I'm not allowed to be. That annoys him too. But I'm proud. I'm really proud of what he's achieved. I'm in awe, actually, of how hard he works, because I'm a hard worker and he's got that gene and runs with it big time.
Especially at such a young age already.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. It was great talking to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.